Like notes through the hour glass, these are the songs of our lives. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Songs of Our Lives. I am Brad Rose. I am a musician, a composer, a writer, the founder of Foxy Digitalis, and someone who thinks about music and sound far more than is probably healthy. Each week, I invite on a guest and we talk about the music and the songs that have meant the most to them and followed them or taken them on their journey. Something like that. I don't know. This week, I am thrilled. Absolutely thrilled to have the one and the only Cab Aired. I've known them for a long time. After we recorded this, I was trying to remember the first time that Kat and I had kind of crossed paths, and I found an interview. I had to use the Wayback Machine because I couldn't find it on my hard drive, although it may still exist there. I'm going to look some more. But back when they used the moniker Traveling Bell for their solo work. I did an interview in Foxy Digitalis in 2006, and there may have been a review of something of Traveling Bells earlier than that, but it's been at least that long, which is almost 20 years. And in that time, they've made so much incredible music, done so many things. It's kind of hard for me to get my head around just thinking back to those early days. And then their new album that comes out on March 22nd, on Revenge International, called Bearings, Soundtracks for the Bardos. This album is so remarkable, and it is so, I mean, it's something special, y'all. I have, like I said, I've been a fan of Kaz's work for a long, long time, but this, to me, this just, it feels like the culmination of so much that they've been doing and like investigating and working on and all of these things. And it really is, it's just something. And I can't recommend it enough. We had so much fun this episode. You'll hear that. We're cracking up the whole time. And I do want to say a special mention here in the Patreon edition of this episode. You know, there's a Patreon section that has some extra questions, and Kat didn't want to do those questions and sent me other ones that were so good that I'm going to have to like incorporate them into like a remix episode of the show or something. Cause there's some really good ones there. So if you're listening on Patreon, awesome. You're in for a treat. If you're not, hey, maybe it's a good time to give it a shot. $3 a month and you can hear that. But the episode, even without that, it's fantastic. So, reminder, Bearings, Soundtracks for the Bardos is out on March 22nd on Revenge International. And Kat is going on tour starting, I believe, on the 12th of March. The link is in the show notes, and they're going out with Horse Lords. And so there's a lot of dates throughout March, and then Europe in April. And yeah, so check out the link in the show notes. If they're coming near you, starts out in Minneapolis, playing Chicago, Cleveland, a lot of Midwest dates, then on the East Coast and stuff, go out and see them. You don't want to miss that, especially with Horse Lords. I mean, God, what a hell of a show that is. Okay, so yeah, we recorded this a couple weeks ago. It was a blast. I hope you like it. My guest today is a musician, a composer, a vocalist, and an all-around wizard with a microphone. It is Cab Aired. Woo! How's it going?
Hey there.
You got a new record coming out called Bearings, Soundtracks for the Bardos. Did I say that right? Is it Bardos? Bardos?
Bardos. Yeah, I think okay. That's right.
Which I love that title. Is there a story behind the name? The name just so fits the music to me.
Yeah, I guess the title came from a commissioned piece I did the the year before in 2022. It was in the spring of 2022. I did a performance through the Lampo Foundation in Chicago. Oh, yeah. And they have this office series where, and they had this before COVID, but it was particularly convenient during COVID, where they would have performances in their very small office space on the top floor of this Chicago historic building called the like Monadnock building that overlooked like the Chicago city skyline. You could even see some kind of prison on one side with little slit windows. Anyway, it was kind of intense. But anyway, so I did this like 20-minute performance five times, two nights in a row for audiences of 1, 2, 3, and 4. So there were these very intimate performances, yeah. And it was one of the most unique performance settings I've ever been in. And I entitled that piece Bearings. And essentially what the record became was kind of an expanded version of that performance. And I think the title came from this idea of the idea of a bardo, which in Tibetan essentially means any kind of in between. It's commonly thought of as the time between death and rebirth, but it also is any kind of in between. So there's like the dream in between, the life in between, the meditation in between. And so I, this record was looking at all of these various in betweens and the idea of bearings, trying to kind of get your foothold with all of this impermanence. And so it's like kind of this idea that we are always in a bardo because impermanence never takes a break.
Yeah. Wow. That's hearing all that. Cause like the record really has resonated with me. And I make like one of the things that I think about a lot in my own work is those like in between spaces and moments, I think is like such, I don't know. It's like this really powerful, mysterious idea to me that I like to think about and I like to explore. So I think, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So there's like, I call all of the tracks on the albums gates. Yeah. So it's gate 1 through 11. And yeah, there's definitely sort of a tension that runs through the entire record, but I think that it's balanced by moments of relief and moments of even comic relief at times. Yeah.
I think that's like one of the things that I think there's a lot of emotions. Like, I mean, this record to me, it like kind of runs this like gauntlet of different emotions, but like one of the things that I really responded to is like that comic relief and like moments of joy and it's fun. Like it's fun, right? Like I think those are emotions that I respond to. Like, we live in a very heavy world and there's a lot of heavy thing and we're all dealing with a lot of heavy stuff, but like I think when you can weave those sort of things into something like this, it just hits even harder to me. And so I think that's really awesome.
Sure. I mean, I think my performance style, it's become very visceral and physical over the years. Mm-hmm. And so my live set is also a very different thing than the recorded material, which was a challenge to try to represent what I do live on a recording. But right. I mean, this idea of bearings in this performance, it's like I'm kind of shifting between these characters of like some kind of shaman or wizard or some kind of athlete or some kind of like magician who doesn't even understand like their powers sometimes, and it gets out of control and it gets unruly at times. Or there's even, you know, like some nods to slapstick comedy as well that I kind of throw into the mix as well. So it's kind of these like shifting roles that I take in performance settings.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I know you're about to go on tour here in the next couple of weeks. Are you going to be like, are you going to be performing this material? How are you approaching that? Like taking this and going on the road and all this?
Yeah. Things? It's a very specific kind of performance. And I'm realizing, at least in the US, I'm going to be performing at a lot of like rock clubs, and we'll see how that translates, because there's moments of, I play a lot with silence in my sets, mm-hmm. a very, very, very like active silences, if you will. And, I'm just wondering how those might translate in certain rock clubs. I also really prefer to perform off stage in front of the speakers. Yeah. And I like to be really close to the audience. I don't necessarily involve the audience, but I like to be close. Mm-hmm. And so I'm also not sure how that will translate in rock clubs. But I will be doing most of this record. I don't think I'm going to be doing all of the entire thing live, but I'll be doing a good chunk of it live. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear how that goes. I think it'll be cool. I don't know. I think, especially because you're going out with Horse Lords, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
I feel like the audience, like their audience will, that feels like a receptive audience to something different. So I think that's cool.
Yeah, I think so. And both Max Albacher and Andrew Bernstein are both on the record. So,
right. Well, that's a good segue to real quick. There's all sorts of like rad collaborators on the record. Did those just kind of happen? Like, I'm wondering how, you know, the people who ended up on the record and kind of, you know, in general for you, like collaboration, what it adds and to your own practice and stuff.
Yeah. Well, this record was composed primarily in solitude throughout the pandemic. And then the year following 2022, my mother was diagnosed with a terminal illness and I was caretaking her that whole year in Illinois. So I was essentially like away from my music community for like 3 years. Wow. And it was really, really important when I came back to New York to involve some of the incredible, just amazing musicians I've had the fortune to meet here in the city. And some I didn't even know that well. I just knew how much I loved their playing. And so I almost took it to an extreme degree, because their contributions are all fairly minimal on the record. Mm-hmm. But it's like I needed the record to be imbued with community after being so kind of isolated for so long. Mm-hmm. And then just to add on top of that, while this record was all composed by me and primarily what I travel and tour with is my solo project, in New York, a very important part of my practice is improvisation. And so I will do gigs fairly regularly with many of these musicians that are here on the roster in totally unplanned, unmapped improv settings as well. And that kind of contrasts with this record, which is more composed.
Yeah, that's awesome. I relate to a lot of that. So all of these things you're telling me, like, yeah, no wonder I love this record. It's like the, and as we're going to get into, like, your song list that you sent me is, oh man, I've had so much fun with this. I mean, it's a lot of
stuff
I could talk about forever, but so with that, let's get into it. And as ever, we start with, what is the first song that you remember?
Right. So I doubt this was the first song that I heard, of course, but the song that really made this like indelible print on me was Rainbow Connection off the Muppet Movie soundtrack in 1979, which I guess I have to give kudos to Paul Williams and Kenneth Asher, who wrote it. I was born in 1976, full disclosure. And I think this film came out in 1979. Okay. And we had this Muppet Movie soundtrack on LP. And I have these very visceral memories of the whole vinyl experience growing up. We had two LP players, one downstairs and one upstairs. Wow. The one downstairs was more in this like old antique pie chest. And one upstairs was this kind of cheap plastic, maybe Fisher Pricey one that, you know, Matt and I, my brother, would play a lot of our records on. But anyway, just thinking about it like takes me back to the smell of that pie chest or like those silly Fisher Price speakers. But anyway, I had to have a hernia surgery when I was in preschool. And I just remember in particular, this record really like help me get through kind of the nervousness of having to go to the hospital and have this, you know, little surgery done for, you know, I think I must have been five or something. And it just, this song, it hit me. And honestly, quite frankly, it still does.
Oh my God. Yeah,
I mean, what? I mean, the lyrics, what the heck?
I know.
I mean, it's so deep.
It like the... The Muppets are a national treasure, as far as I'm concerned, because I have really visceral memories of this movie and this sound, like the soundtrack too. I think so. I'm 3 years younger than you, so you know we're around the same. And my sister is the same age as you, so like very similar. And, like we had this in the house. I remember watching it like over and over. I don't know. I guess we must have had like a VHS tape of it or something. But yeah, it like I was listening to this again last like over the weekend, just like, oh my God, this is like and knowing and you know, like I've said, like I have a 10-year-old daughter, so I listen to a lot of kids' music over the last 10 years, and man, it doesn't go this hard anymore. Like a lot of it does not go this hard.
Well, I was looking at it. I saw that it reached number 25 on the Billboard Hot 100, which I guess, you know, yeah, some of these Disney songs certainly do that too, but
I don't know. I love this. And I mean, I just love the Muppets. The Muppets Christmas Carol, for anybody who hasn't seen it, is like one of the greatest Christmas music movies ever. So
totally. And one other thing I wanted to add along to this was like, I said, how like, I mean, I think this song was like my first experience of a song transporting me and coloring, enhancing my experience of life and getting very wistful and all such. And I think like shortly after we were about to go back to school after Christmas vacation. And I love Christmas as a kid. I mean, who doesn't as a kid?
Right.
I mean, I guess there are some, but, and the thought of going back to school was so sad. And so I remember putting on this Christmas record, probably Gene Autry's like Christmas record, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, on like January 5th or whatever day it was before going back to school. And just wallowing in my sorrow, like purposely putting on that Christmas record to trigger more sadness, more nostalgia for the Christmas season that is now gone. And I just like think about that. I'm just like, wow, the power of music and like wanting to be sad or letting music allow you to really express your sadness.
I know. Well, that's again, perfect segue here. What's the song that makes you cry?
Yeah. So, I realize I've been pronouncing her name wrong all this time. It's pronounced Sybilla Bear. And I picked the track Says Elliot off of her record, The Color Green or Color Green, which I'm not sure if you're familiar. It was released in 2006. I mean, this album was recorded in the late 70s in Sybilla's home on a reel-to-reel recording device. And there are these just little short, just gems of songs that just sort of like distill existential, like emotional pain and beauty. I mean, they're heartbreaking, every single fucking one of them.
I know.
And so yeah, decades later, her son, who is a musician and producer, discovered this reel-to-reel and was blown away and started to distribute the music to close family and friends, one of whom was Jay Maskus, who sent it to Orange Twin Records in Athens, Georgia. And it finally was released in 2006. Wow. What's that, like 35 years later?
Yeah.
And anyway, I could have probably picked any of the tracks from this record.
Sure.
I picked Says Elliot because it also references one of my favorite poets, who is T.S. Eliot. It's from the poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, where they're like, I grow old, I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled, says Elliot. And then there's a couple other references to the T.S. Eliot poem as well. But I mean, it's just, you know, let us try to unlearn, says Elliot. He seeks for return and burns ancient love letters anyway.
Oh my gosh.
Tears.
Yeah.
Tears.
No, so I completely missed this. And so this is new to me, and it totally just like knocked me down. It was so, and I've listened to the whole record a couple times, and since
isn't it incredible?
Oh my God. And I think, you know, I think about that kind of thing all the time. It's like, how much stuff is there like this just sitting in a box somewhere that nobody knows about? And, you know, I don't know, like, that's, but you know, eventually it finds its way out when it needs to, I guess.
Or does it? It may not all the time. Yeah, I know. She's probably lucky she had a curious son.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's what a story. God.
Man, yeah.
I had no idea about the Jay Maskus connection too. That's,
yeah, I read about that last week when I was just like looking up the song more, which is interesting. Yeah. But yeah, just such pure distilled gems. I recommend this to everyone. Color Green by Sybilla Bear.
Yeah, I'm second that. I don't know if it's still in print or not, but I'm determined to like find an actual copy of it, because it feels like a record I want to like go sit in the dark and listen to and just cry. Like when I need to just get it out, right?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Well, on the flip side of that, what's the song that puts you in a better mood?
Well, first of all, I realized a lot of my selections come from the 70s, which I still stand as like, I don't know, my favorite decade of music.
Yeah.
But a lot of it, I think, is like just harkening back to sort of my formative years as a musician. I picked very few like super recent tracks, even though I do listen to music still. I do. But yeah, for this one, I picked Raincoat's Fairy Tale in the Supermarket. I mean, this has been on my like playlist since I was 16, essentially. Yeah. And like the spirit of this song and the spirit of this album and the spirit of this group are just where it is at, and was so formative for me as a musician and as a person. I mean, I think I was first introduced to the Raincoats through some mention by Kurt Cobain
in some interview.
100%. Yeah. He's like, I like to go up to the attic and listen to Raincoats or something like that. And so I was, definitely, you know, he was huge when I was in high school. And so I think I decided to hate the Grateful Dead because of him before even listening to one song.
Same. Oh my God. Yeah. I often say like there's so, I don't know that I would be where I am now if it wasn't for Kurt Cobain. And it's kind of, I remember reading a book of his, and I think it's actually a new version of it just came out, not a book of his, a book about Nirvana. And it talked a lot about the stuff like he was into and people he knew, like, and being this voracious, curious music fan, I just wanted to hear all of it. And that's
absolutely,
and the Raincoats are like one of the most like staying power of all of that stuff, because this is like one of the greatest, like the greatest debut albums ever made. I think it's so, God, it's so good.
Yeah. I mean, I have the 33 and a third book by Jen Paley about the record, which I highly recommend if you don't have it, where it just talks in detail about all of them. I mean, it was definitely all very much steeped in like squat culture. I think their practice space was in some squat, I think Vicky's squat or something like that. And just has a lot of insanely great quotes from various critics and herself. I mean, they were so DIY and so like raw, and then Rough Trade releases it, which is just incredible, you know? And one other thing I just wanted to mention about, but I mean, yeah, just the lyrics of this song too. It's just like, just this total like DIY. It makes no difference night or day. No one teaches you how to live. Like, I'm going to figure my own way. I'm going to figure out how to live my own way. And then that chorus of, oh, honey, don't worry. This is just a fairy tale happening in the supermarket. And it's so raw and dirty. And I love it so much.
Yeah,
and the final thing I'll say,
there's this like chaos to it that is so, it's infectious. It's just like, oh my God, I love it.
Yeah. So yeah, the last thing I wanted to say was, so in college, my friends and I were all very inspired by the Slits and the Raincoats. And my first band in college, which I think we played maybe a grand total of one show, maybe one and a half, but one of them like kind of like ended in disarray, was named Paul Molev, a reference to the drummer in both bands. And also to the soap as well, like kind of a double meaning. Anyway.
Excellent. I love it. Yeah. God, no, this is like, I still remember when, I mean, I don't remember the exact moment hearing this record for the first time, but like general, because I think I was probably like 14 or something. And it's a record that has just stayed with me and stayed with me. And like, it never gets old. It's never, it's, yeah.
Absolutely.
In this song too, like I think this was even like the first song they released, because I think it was like a 7-inch before the record or something. Like,
yes.
My God, how to come out the gates just. But yeah,
incredible.
Well, I think you could. I think Fairy Tale in the Supermarket could be an answer to this next question, but what is objectively the greatest song of all time?
All right. So this question was absolutely impossible for me. So I objectively, what? So I decided to choose one of my all time favorite musicians, Alice Coltrane. And the track Universal Consciousness. I was just like, let's go for it. Like, if you want me to go objective, okay. Right. I mean, and then, yeah, I mean, I, upon like, you know, like learning more about the song, it's like, you know, I mean, this was an album, I think, that Alice recorded after she got back from India for the first time. So she brought back a lot of like influences from her travels. She started playing the Wurlitzer organ on this record for the first time, which she thought kind of mimicked the harmonium or timbre a little bit. And I don't know, some critics have considered this album to be like a forerunner to the world music movement, whatever that means. That's such like a generic term. But when you think about it, it's like, you know, it absorbs traditions of like the Black church, Indian chanting, Euroclassical strings and jazz, like all together. Like, I'll throw that out in my like space bubble to the next planet.
Yeah. I mean, Alice Coltrane's. Yeah. If somebody was like, you can only pick one person, like your favorite musician, it would probably be her. And her music genuinely like makes me believe in like higher consciousness and higher states of being, and because it takes you there. And I'm also shocked that this is about the 25th episode of this I've recorded. Alice has not come. No, she came up once. I think she maybe came up. I don't. And it shocks me because I think she's the greatest, but it also gives me the opportunity to make my stupid joke of imagine being John Coltrane and you're still only the second best Coltrane that ever lived.
Yes.
I fucking love John Coltrane. That is wrong. Alice to me is just, I love her so much.
I hold her dear. Yeah.
Did you see that new reissue or thing that got announced last week? It's a live show from this period, actually. It was 71 Carnegie Hall show. Yeah, it's coming out.
I did not. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. I guess, I guess Universal Consciousness was like a trilogy that came out where she was using strings on all three. Like Lord of Lords is one, and World of Galaxy maybe is the other.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were a few. 1971 was a pretty good year.
Pretty good year. But yes, Alice Coltrane.
For music.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, what's the song you used to love, but you've heard it recently, or when you think about it now, it doesn't quite do it for you the same way?
All right. So yeah, this question was also a bit hard for me as well, because I feel like I can still listen to most songs I listened to when I was a kid, and I still enjoy it for reasons that connect me to that time in history, even if the aesthetic is nowhere near what I'm going for now. It's just this way of like linking time for me. It's and so it's hard for me to be a harsh critic, even like case in point being the Smiths and Morrissey, where that was just part of my Midwestern alternative music formation. And now Morrissey has become like a totally egomaniac bad politics dude. Right. But for this one, I did say Courtney Love's 90s outfit Hole with the song Teenage Whore, which actually I listened to last night just to reference it, and I was kind of digging it. So
nice.
But anyway, here we are. Yeah. I mean, that record just seems sort of silly now, and I think to an extent I thought it was silly then. I mean, an early version of Spires way back in 1997, Spires and the Sunset Rise was my band that I was in from like 2001 till I guess present, although we're pretty inactive these days. But an early version of Spires way back in 1997, we made a very lo-fi DIY John Waters feature film called Scum Kid in Champaign, Illinois. And it was this twisted tale of this duo, Kitten and Mitten, and particularly Kitten, who I plays, obsession with starting a band and her diehard determination for success.
Oh my God.
And it gets way, way out of control. And that track by Hole plays during the film after I end up getting knocked up by some fake record producer.
Oh my God.
And I end up giving birth to like 6 children. And it's a total tragic comedy. It's Tara just uploaded it to YouTube, FYI.
Oh,
but
amazing.
I'll send you the link.
Okay. I'll include the show notes here. So people...
But yeah, I mean, I think Courtney Love is a complicated person. I don't feel the need to bash her per se, because I just don't know. But I did hear her on Marc Maron's What the Fuck a couple years ago. And while many listeners like spewed their hate about the show, I thought it was a trip of an interview. It was like this postmodern cruise through pop culture, like all her references. Now she jumped from this to that. I mean, she's definitely manic, I think. And I thought it was like art. So
there you go. I remember buying this record. And I mean, obviously Hole, like, the Nirvana connection is where that all came from for me. And I think when I first heard this, I mean, I think I was just, you know, I was like 14 or something. I was like, you know, and then kind of, I probably hadn't listened to this in 20 years, maybe. I don't know. It'd been a long time until this. And it was like equal parts. Like, yeah, this kind of is awesome. And also like, it's just kind of, but it did. It very much took me back to that. Like, I'm right there with you. Takes me back.
Thanks for the solidarity.
Yeah, and like stuff that takes you back to a certain, like it evokes memories and like feelings and like of a time. You know, I mean, that's there's always something cool about that. I mean, you know, and like the Morrissey example. You know, this is something I think about a lot of times, is because you know, there's a lot of music that I love that's made by people who are maybe not the best people, and separating those things and like you know, not ignoring it, being like, yeah, like this person sucks but also like they made this thing back when I was, you know, this formative thing for me, so I can't just, yeah, it's like you can hold two thoughts at once, I think, is it's not, you know.
Yeah.
And obviously that's different for everybody, like, and everybody's got to figure that out for themselves. Like, everybody's got a different line. And
yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not going to like, come, like, if somebody who's never heard of the Smiths, which doesn't exist, but like, you got to come over. I got to play your song. Like, I'm not going to do that. Okay. Exactly. But am I going to listen to the Smiths in my little headphones when I'm by myself, like going on a walk? Maybe.
Exactly. And that's, there you go. Nailed it. okay, well, what, this one's always tricky, because this one was tricky for, is tricky for me, but I was curious to hear people's context for this. A song that people hate, some group of people, some specific person even. People hate, but you love it anyway. You don't care.
Okay, yeah. So I answered this also with a very specific lens. I picked the song Drip Drip by Comus from their album First Utterance, also 1971. Yeah. And I mean, I know this album and this band have a solid, very solid cult following. And I mean, so honestly, many of my deep weirdo music friends love this record and song. And I picked this record, because it has happened more than once that I've put it on Drip Drip for like a girlfriend or friend. And it is clear pretty early on that it is a bit much. Yeah, at this moment in time, okay, and I mean it is intense,
it is the whole record.
And apparently it is also about necrophilia, which is no easy walk in the park.
I didn't realize that. That's pretty holy shit. Yeah, that's an acquired taste.
but I mean this band, oh my god, they're incredible. I mean,
oh my god,
a huge influence again on my music formation was my friend Steve Krakow, also known as Plastic Crime Wave. Yeah. I'm not sure if you're familiar, I've known him since I was 18. And he would send Tara Lee and I cassette tapes in the mail and in person with like incredible influences of no wave, Japanese noise bands, early psychedelia, folk music. One tape in particular was heavily played, and on one side was Comus First Utterance, and on the other side was Vashti Bunyan, Just Another Diamond Day.
Oh.
And Tara and I were sort of living in a van at the time, and we would play this cassette so much. And so it was a huge
dichotomy too of like First Utterance. You say that, and then thinking of like Spires, and I'm like, okay, I can see it. I can see it.
Totally. I mean, they're like paganism and like progressive rock moments. I mean, I don't think it was it wasn't like let's sound like Comus,
sure.
But I mean, they were looming over us as this like idea.
I think that's how you and I probably first met, like long ago, was in the Spires days, because I was talking about this maybe with my wife, someone, like I remember being in Chicago, this is like probably 2005 or 2006, and this is back when Sarah Hennies was in the band The Weird Weeds, and we happened to be there for some other reason, and then The Weird Weeds were playing at the Empty Bottle, I think. And I remember going and like hanging out with Sarah. And then I remember meeting, I know I met Tara Lee that night, but I swear I just have it's a weird memory that I'm surprised I remember. But I don't know. I'm a huge fan of all the Spires stuff. So
thank you.
So I'm really excited to see this movie.
Oh my, you will love it. You will love it. I mean, I think. It's very histrionic. Yeah, like lots of screaming.
Oh, excellent. Oh man. But yeah, Comus, God, this is they're just wild. Just the way that it goes for it's like one idea to the net, and how they stitch it all together is it blows my mind. It does so much. And it makes sense in their way.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, if there was a question for best album, like, you know, just because of the way it flows into each other, it's really a masterpiece.
Might get ducked a few points for the necrophilia thing, but
I know.
You know, it's art. It's fine. Okay, well, it's definitely not Drip Drip, but what is the most romantic song? If it is Drip Drip, then wow.
Oh my. Okay, well, this was something that I just I picked Tricky, the track Overcome from the album Max and Quay. Not sure if I'm saying that right, actually. And this was like an album I was into when I was younger. And I just recently kind of revisited it maybe like a year or two ago. Uh-huh. And I put on that track Overcome. It's like, yeah, it's like, and I got kind of entranced by it. And I played it several times. Like, this song is so romantic / sexy. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's, I don't know if I have a whole much more to say about it other than that. I mean.
Yeah, no, like if this could also be like the sexiest song too. Like, it's in that zone. And it, like, the production and the rhythm and all of like the music definitely helps, but God, it's the vocal performance is so like vulnerable and just entrancing. And it's like you're held in the palm of her hand, just like.
It's incredible. Yeah. Shout out to Martina Topley Bird, who I guess was the vocalist that he was working with on that record.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't listen to a ton of trip hop, but damn.
It's a good
maybe
one.
I should.
I know. I need to put this on my like playlist for like, I don't have a Valentine's Day playlist or anything, but if I did, this needs to go on. Okay, well, what's the song that changed your perspective on an artist, either for better or for worse?
Sure. I had a few different ones on this one, and I ended up going with this one. And again, I feel like I'm referencing kind of an earlier time in my life. So be it.
Yeah.
I chose Joanna Newsom, Only Skin, from 2006. When Spires first started playing music, you know, we found ourselves steeped in this like new weird America movement, this freak folk movement, and who Spires and honestly Joanna Newsom both found themselves in at very opposite ends of the spectrum, and in fact, when the Incredible String Band came to tour the U.S. I think in 2004, I was trying to find the date, and I can't say that for sure, but it was somewhere around then. A lot of these freak folkers opened up for them, including Spires, plus Joanna Newsom, Josephine Foster, Esper's Six Organs of Admittance, all those guys. And at the time, I was sort of ambivalent about Joanna, and maybe even actively not into her first record, The Milk-Eyed Mender. It just didn't really grab me. I thought her voice was kind of annoying. But when the album Wise came out in 2006, with that like those lush string arrangements and the episodic long winding lyrics, I mean, of note Only Skin in particular, like I became a true blue devoted Joanna Newsom fan. Like, I could probably karaoke Only Skin, or like I'm trying to stay awake in the car, like I'll put that song on and I can sing the entire thing.
Same.
Really?
Oh my God, dude. I'm a huge Joanna Newsom fan. I keep saying to people, like, the thing that's, if we're gonna make it through 2024, we need a new Joanna Newsom album.
Yeah, what the heck? What is she, Joanna?
She's been playing new songs. Like, there's shows that she's done last year or so that's all new songs. So
I guess she has two children now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. And her song, you know, I talked about this with somebody, like, it feels like she kind of, like, every record is like a different thing. And so, that takes a lot. I don't know. But this song, oh my God, what an unbelievable
piece. Wise and Have One On Me were the two records that really got me. I wasn't as into the next one she put out. Was it Divers or something? Divers. That one I wasn't as into. But I don't know. She's just an example of artists that, I mean, I can't convince you again to like, if you kind of have to get it or not get it, you know, but her magic with words and melody is just utterly unique and defining and masterful, and Only Skin just like nails it, you know, with that end part where Bill Callahan comes in and they're singing together.
This song, like it totally just kind of like takes you everywhere and rakes you over the coals. And then Bill Callahan shows up just to like put the final nail in of like,
totally. And I mean, I was so convinced to like use this as my best lyrics one, but I stopped for a second just because it's like, I could have easily done that. I could have easily done that. But I realized like when I, like her songs and the music, I feel are so intricately connected that when I went back and just read the lyrics, I mean, they're still powerful, no doubt, but like, it's with the music that makes them make sense.
Yeah, like if you take it outside of the context of the song, it's, you know, it's still really, yeah, it's still really good, but it's not the same. Oh my god, yeah. And this song, like, this is, I don't know, this is like the song, like, for her. I love this song so much. I saw something recently because somebody else actually picked this for something else, but I never knew this same song. Yeah, I think it was their, like, the song they've listened to the most, and he was like, I literally just sorted my, like, iTunes, and this was the song I listened to. He's like, it wasn't even close. I was like, I believe it. But what's really, I didn't realize this, is she talked about, in this interview I read, where she was talking about this record, and she was saying, like, Only Skin is the song that ties the whole thing together, and if you look at it, like, the two middle letters of the song title are YS. And
that's really cool. Awesome. I never knew that.
That's, I didn't either. So that's my Joanna Newsom trivia. I love Joanna Newsom. I hope there's a new one this year, but who knows?
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Okay, well, what are your favorite lyrics then? If it's not Only Skin, which
I know. I was sort of hesitant to include this because I felt like it is maybe too obvious of a choice, but I was just like, fuck it. It just is. I picked Leonard Cohen's Stories of the Street from 1967. It's just so good. It's just...
Every line is a work of art.
Every single line. One hand on my suicide, one hand on the rose. I know if you've heard it's over now, war must surely come. The cities, they are broken half and the middlemen are gone. But let me ask you one more time, oh children of the dusk, all these hunters who are shrieking now, oh do they speak for us? And then that maybe my favorite line of the whole thing is, the age of lust is giving birth and both the parents ask the nurse to tell them fairy tales on both sides of the glass. And now the infant with his cord is hauled in like a kite, and one eye filled with blueprints and one eye filled with night. And then finally, one more. I just have to let it out. Oh, come with me, my little one. We will find that farm and grow us grass and apples there and keep all the animals warm. And if by chance I wake at night and I ask you who I am, oh, take me to the slaughterhouse. I will wait there with the lamb.
Oh, gosh, it's so good. Every line. Like, and see, and that is, like, outside of the context of the music, that is still nailed on brilliant. Like, oh my gosh, it's so good.
It just doesn't get better. Yeah. No,
and you would think, like, Leonard Cohen is an off, like, nobody's answered Leonard Cohen.
Really? Oh my god. Okay. Yeah. Well, so, okay. It's high time.
Yeah, the band-aid need to be ripped off. No, that's I love Leonard Cohen, and this is such a good pick for that. Like, you could, there's like so many of his songs, like, the lyrics are incredible, but this is such, because it is like, he doesn't waste, like, a single word.
Oof.
So
I don't know if he does in any of his songs, honestly.
He is, oh my god. Yeah. I have an idea to do episodes of, like, shorter episodes of this show for probably, like, for the Patreon or something, where it's like 6 or 7 questions, but you have to only answer with songs from one artist.
Totally. Like, Leonard would be a good one for that.
Yeah. So someday I will, if I ever have time.
Such a rich catalog.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So what song have you or can you listen to the most?
So for this one, I chose the German experimental rock band Can and their track Vitamin C from 1972.
Again, could have been objectively the greatest song of all time.
Exactly. Can has been, I think Can was also one of the bands that my friend Steve Krakow had on one of these early cassettes back in the day. I don't remember what was on the other side. Maybe it was another Can album, like Taco Mago or something. But Iggy Bamyasi, I mean, that album from start to finish is just incredible. Spires early on, we covered Swan Song.
That's hard to say.
I think that's what it's called, a sing swan song. But this, yeah, this record, I mean, it's just, it's this combination of, you know, these incredible musicians. I think several of them, I know like Holger Chikai and the other guy, what's his name? Maybe Jackie Libetzite or something. I'm forgetting. Yeah, I might be pronouncing their names wrong. They were both, you know, like students of Karl Heinz Stockhausen, you know? So they came from this really kind of like high art music,
right?
Electronic scene, but then started this incredible rock band. And then when Damo Suzuki entered the picture, it just became just the best.
I Can is one of those bands that just kind of cracked my head open, and it makes you realize like, oh, like there's anything's possible. Like you can, it just sort of like, I don't know, it warps your perspective, like in a good way of, because like, yeah, thinking about those guys' background, like with Stockhausen, and then taking that and becoming like, bringing that to like a rock outfit, and then and then Damo. I mean, you know,
Damo was like the icing on the cake.
He was like the glue that like held it together and just kind of launched it into another. Like,
And rest in peace, Damo Suzuki. And I've learned in the last couple of days since he passed, or was it just yesterday, or I think it was 2 days ago. That about the story of them finding him, like, I think Holger and Jackie, they like found him busking outside of a Munich cafe.
That's right. I saw
And they were like talking, like, cause I guess Malcolm, Mooney, who was their previous singer, left the band, was having some mental health issues or something. And so they were like trying to like figure out like, God, who could sing in our band? And they were like walking, and they passed Damo Suzuki at this cafe busking, and just, I don't even know what he was. Maybe he had a guitar, but I think he could only play like a couple chords. But I mean, his style was like, I think it was always like fairly improvisatory. Like, I think he eventually nailed down a few lyrics, but I think often he was improvising his lyrics.
That story, I read that the other day too. It was just like,
And I don't really know a ton about Damo Suzuki's like life. I've been reading a little bit in the last couple of days, just since his passing. And I guess there is a book called I Am Damo Suzuki that I would love to, I would love to read.
Did you ever meet him or anything?
I think I saw them play once in Chicago. And I don't know, maybe I waved at him or something, but I know several people who did.
Yeah. I mean, he was around like,
Oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say, like I remember hearing stories of people like hanging out with him, and it just being like, wait, what? Like, you were just hanging out with Damo Suzuki? It's like, yeah, he was in town, and blew my mind. I never met him, but
I mean, I just read that he left Cannes at one point to become a Jehovah's Witness for a couple years, but that only lasted a couple years, and then since then he went back to music, and I think just was a very community guy, very approachable.
It's inspirational, genuinely. Cause that's, I always think about it. It's like, that's what I want to be, that for people, like be the person that, I don't know, that brings other people together and is, can be that, you know, like be like Damo Suzuki.
Yeah.
Not a bad thing.
I think so.
Well, what's the last song you completely fell in love with?
So for this one, I picked the song by MC Yala, who's a Kenyan rapper. I think she's based in Uganda, maybe was originally from Kenya and is affiliated with that Nyegi Nyegi festival. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, and they put out a record of hers last year, like a full length of hers last year.
And so I think the track I picked was a Kabali, but her new record is amazing as well. Yeah. And I met her at the Unsound Festival in 2019.
Oh, wow.
We were like backstage together and just she was super, super nice and was trying to like get me to come play the Nyegi Nyegi Festival, which I would be open to if that was to happen. But damn, I just think this album, which I picked, I think the album is called Kabali, but I picked the track Kabali as well. I just love it. It's one of my favorite tracks to play people right now who haven't heard it. It's just like, I don't know what she's saying. I think they're all in these like native African languages is my understanding. Mm-hmm. But it's intense and it's fierce.
Yeah.
And apparently she's singing about like women's issues and stuff like that. I can't testify to that, but anyway, so on this album, she joined forces with this DJ who goes by Debmaster, who I think just like the combination of them is incredible. And I can't wait to hear more and more of what they do. They've been on the circuit pretty actively the last few years. They're definitely on the radar of some like major European festivals. And so they're out there and they're busy.
I think she was supposed to come to the U.S. last year. And then had visa issues, and it was a whole thing, of course. But yeah, God, there's just, this, her like flow and with the production, it's just like relentless on this record, but in this good way. Like, it's overwhelming, but I love it so much. I can't get enough of it.
I love it. Yeah.
That whole scene is incredible. Like that, the Nyege Nyege scene, it's blows my mind.
Yes. I mean, I've heard some people tell me stories about the festival and it sounds a little insane. They're like on like, you know, like they didn't, I don't know, on some bike late at night, not knowing where their hotel was. And, you know, it's a whole different infrastructure.
Right.
I don't know if cell phones work there, but they have, or I don't know if they don't, they probably work somewhere around there. I just don't know, like at the festival if they worked. I know they have, I know a few people who have gone and done the residency there. I think there's like 1 or 2 month residencies that you can do before the festival starts. And
that would be amazing.
Yeah.
What an experience.
Yeah. Maybe not totally easy, but
like, you know, a lot of the best things aren't easy. So if it was easy, it wouldn't be the experience that it likely would be.
That's very true, Brad.
Okay, well, we're in the home stretch. Well, next question is, what is the song that means the most to you? Not necessarily because of the song itself, but like you associate it with something or somebody or an experience, and it's,
So for this one, I picked Sinead O'Connor and her epic track, Troy, from her 1987 album, The Lion and the Cobra.
Oh my God. Speaking of, like, we were talking about the raincoat, your first single off your first record is this? Jesus Christ. That's amazing.
She had kind of gotten on my radar again recently, even before, you know, her tragic death recently. She put out a memoir called Remembrance. Yeah. And it's great. I got it as an audiobook and she narrates it. And I love it. And I highly recommend it. So she had been kind of back on my radar for a while. And I you know, that song in particular, Troy, I've like had conversations with people about it. I'm just like, how does that a song like that even get written? You know what I mean? I mean the production is so, you know, I think she worked closely with a production person, but I mean, did they like take her guitar out and then just leave synths at a certain point? Or anyway, it's just a mystery how a song like that gets written. But I mean, that song, oh my God. I recently had a high school reunion with three of my dearest friends, and it was right after Sinead had died. And like after like kind of a late night of having fun, my friend videotaped three of us singing this entire song together and belting it. So I have belted this song so many times, you don't even know. But what's funny is that I always thought at the end of the song, she says, "You're still alive." I thought she was saying, "You're still alive." And she's saying, "You're still a liar."
That changes the meaning quite a bit.
I know it does. But I learned through her rememberings that this track is not some like love song, which I thought it was, of course, when I was a teenager. Right. It's actually a song about her mother, who she had a very complicated relationship with her father. Her mother was, I guess, physically and mentally abusive. And I think this song in particular was talking about a time when she was very little, where her mom like locked her out in the house of the house, and she had to like stay in this like tent in the backyard overnight. And so, and then it also references, she was really into Yeats. She was really into Yeats. And apparently this kind of like is inspired by one of Yeats's poems called No Second Troy, where there's some references to the Trojan War. And maybe she uses that as some kind of metaphor with her mother or something. But
I had anyway, no idea. FYI. Yeah. No, I had no idea. Because, I always thought it was about, like desire. And I mean, in a way, it is desire for love. I mean, it is, how that breaks you.
Yes. And her mother died when she was young. Her mother died in a fatal car crash, I think, when Sinead was 17 or 18. And so, that like ghost of those experiences was quite strong. And she hardly ever performed this song, I guess. She performed it like the year after the record came out, then never performed it again until like many, many years later. And she performed. Wow. So it's a very, I think it's a very, very, very personal song. But I could go on and on and on about Sinead O'Connor in terms of just like who she was and her influence and her martyrdom and how shittily she was treated by the music community, how shittily she was treated by so many people, and just how she was so ahead of her time in so many ways, politically, artistically. She was a badass probably should never have become famous. She never wanted to be famous. And, but her album, those albums are just too freaking good,
they are some of, all time stuff.
I think that was one of the reasons she was also so, active in like, the sexual abuses of the Catholic Church was because she was apparently physically, sexually, and mentally abused by her mother. And so she had that personal experience as a child. And maybe she was even sexually abused by, some other men when she was younger as well.
One of the greats. I'm really excited. I'm going to have to get that audiobook.
I highly recommend it. Yeah. Rememberings. The audiobook is great because she narrates it.
Yeah. That's awesome. That I'm sold. I mean, I've been wanting to read that, but I take walks every day for like an hour. And so I need stuff to listen to, and I don't usually listen to music. I try to get, it's like my time to be away from music. So audiobooks are perfect. So like shooting to the top of the list. All right. Well, we're on the last question. So as of at least this moment in time right now, what is your favorite song?
So for this one, I answered Catherine Ribeiro and the Alps, which were a French band formed in 1968. And the song Aim Debout from, again, 1971.
I was going to say.
I mean, this was a song, again, that I was introduced to many, many, many years ago. I think we were on tour and we were driving like in the desert. And my friend, Tara Burke, who goes by the project for Saxa, she had this in her little tape collection and popped it in our very, very hot and troubled van that broke down several times. And listening to that, like in the desert and just driving, I was just, you know, I was blown away. Somewhat similar to the first time I heard the voice of Diamanda Galaz, which was in New Orleans, and I was downstairs and my neighbor started playing it, and I was like marched right up to her door. I knocked and I was like, what are you playing?
Oh my god.
But similarly, like, I mean, wow. I mean, the combination, though, it's really the combination of Ribeiro, this chanteuse gone wild,
right,
you know,
yeah.
Like just so her vocal delivery was just so intense and so ecstatic, you know, beyond expectation, I think, of what you would think from like some kind of sweet French chanteuse, you know?
Right. It's like, oh my god, yeah, like
she's the antithesis of it, really.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's just like it's just like venom. I mean, it's just like she's, oh my god, like the distortion in her voice and like the grit and just.
Oh yeah, the gravel. Yeah, and I mean, I think that Mexican Summer, the label, they did some, I don't know if they were involved in some kind of reissue or maybe they put out like a compilation of some tracks dedicated to them or something. I have to look that back up again. But I remember reading at the time, though, on their site, some more about Catherine, and they talked a little bit about her biography and how like her brother died when she was an infant and her first years of life were spent underground during the bomb raids in Paris. And so maybe that provides some of the context for her intensity. Right. And I guess she did have a strong dedication to political issues her entire career life. I mean, she's still alive is my understanding. I feel like there was like a rumor a few years ago that like she died, but I have not heard anything. And I felt like there were also rumors that she had lost her mind and was in some asylum. And I really wish people would just, you know,
leave it alone.
Leave it alone, because who knows and who cares, I guess. So, but anyway, the combination of her and the band, I mean, the band itself also was incredible. I don't know if you've listened to any of like, there's a few documentaries out there. They're in French. I think maybe there are subtitles for one of them, but they used a lot of, they made like some very early version of a drum machine that is featured on this track, Aim Debout. It's like that.
I was wondering, I know what you're talking, that sound you're talking about, because I even have a note in here. Like, is it sound? I was like, some kind of tabla sounding thing.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the members of Alps was an instrument designer, I guess. And he constructed these like motor driven beat boxes that sound like bicycle derailers tapping congas.
That's amazing.
And it does totally sound like almost a tabla, but apparently it's some kind of like weird machine.
That's cool.
Weird rhythm, very early weird rhythm machine. But anyway, this song, I mean, I don't, you know, it's just one of those anthems for me, you know.
It's such a great song. Yeah, no, 1971, that's the recurring, I can't believe how it's amazing. I'm kind of blown away, because like, you know, a lot of this stuff I knew these songs and like it's a lot of music that I love, but I never stitched together how many came the same year. Man, 1971 was on one.
Right, Right?
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really one for years, really. But when I was compiling this list, I was like, okay, I got to know when all these things came out.
Right.
And then seeing that, wow, 1971.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Somebody needs, there's, yeah, I'm like, there's like a, there's something, there's like a documentary or something there. Like, how did all this weird, incredible stuff come out in 1971? What was in the ether at that moment? I mean, a lot of things were going on, obviously.
Right.
But,
right.
Huh. Well, this was awesome. This was way too much fun. I really appreciate doing this. I really hope everybody checks out the record, which is out on March 22nd. I didn't mention that at the beginning on Revenge International. This was awesome. Thank you so much. Once again, thank you so much to Cab Baird for taking the time, for being so prepared. Oh, this was just, oh, it was so good. Like every time I think about the recording this episode, I just feel happy. So I hope you all dug it as much as I did. Remember to check out the playlist of their picks in the show notes. Get the new record, Bearings, Soundtracks with Bardos, March 22nd, Revenge International. Go see them on tour. All of those things. Do them all, but especially get the record. That's it. If you want to holler at me, you know where to find me. Foxy Digitalis on social media, patreon.com/FoxyDigitalis. And hey, if you don't want to throw a few bucks at the Foxy Digitalis Patreon, throw them towards buying Kaz record or going and see them live. Until the next time with somebody else, keep on listening, whatever the hell you want.